Welcome, everyone, to the Waking Up the Workplace interview series. The aim of this series is to explore the cutting edge of conscious business. And it's really nice to be back on the call with you, for those who have been listening in before. It's been a couple of months since our last interview. We actually did a series of 14 interviews earlier this year. And we decided that we wanted to continue. Actually, the response has been so overwhelmingly positive, and we've been loving these so much that we've decided to do at least another three this year. So this is the first out of those three. And today we're going to be talking to David Allen, who I'm going to be introducing in a second. In the meantime, with me on the call today is Jeroen. Hi, Jeroen.
Hello, Diederik.
And there's Ewan in the background who's supporting us with technology. And like I said, on the call as well is David Allen, who is widely recognized as the world's leading expert on personal productivity and work-life balance. So he's the originator of Getting Things Done, which is commonly referred to as GTD. And it's a groundbreaking management or work-life management system that has provided people around the world with solutions for going from overwhelm and uncertainty to an integrated system of stress-free productivity. And I can definitely say it has done that for me as well. So he's the best-selling author of Getting Things Done and two other books, and also chairman and CEO of the David Allen Company, whose purpose it is to enhance performance and improve the quality of life by providing the world's best information, education, and products in the fields of personal productivity and work-life balance. So, David, how are you? Actually, I want to say happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, yes. Yes, over here we pick a day to be thankful for things. Not that you shouldn't be every day, but it is nice to have a reason to focus on that. So, yes, thank you.
Yeah, and to be honest, we kind of forgot about Thanksgiving because, of course, we're out here in Europe, in the Netherlands, close to Amsterdam, and it was only a couple of days ago that we realized it's Thanksgiving, so we weren't sure how that was going to play out, but we're actually really grateful to you for being with us today on Thanksgiving.
Sure. Well, I'm thankful that you guys are interested in talking to me and that I have the opportunity and that we have technology that we can do this. And I'm thankful that the world is coming together as one world. I think that's so much fun. It's something I've seen for years that was part of my vision was that, you know, that I would have the opportunity to do what I wanted to do globally because it's a global piece of work. So I'm thrilled. And I love Amsterdam, as we were talking before the call started. You know, it's one of my favorite places. My wife and I would love to live on the canal. And the Netherlands has been extremely incredible, gracious to us. So I'm delighted to connect.
Great. I'm also wondering, like, where are you?
Right now I am enjoying a lovely, probably, let's see, in centigrade, it would probably be about 18 in sunny Santa Barbara, California right now.
That's nice. It's kind of late autumn out here, so I can't say that it's that warm. We're inside, of course, so cool. I mean, we want to dive in pretty quickly. I just want to say a few words about the structure of this call today. We'll have around 60 minutes of kind of three-way conversation between you, David, and Jeroen and myself. And then after that, we'll have some 20 to 30 minutes of Q&A where everyone that's listening in, either by phone or by webcast, is free to throw in their questions, all the questions that we may forget to ask or that may be triggered by our conversation. And in fact, you know, while we're having the conversation, people are free to throw in their questions in the screen, the instant teleseminar screen. There's a box in the lower left where you can put in your questions, and we'll get to those. But in the meantime, I suggest that we dive right in. And there's a question that we have been asking all 14 speakers to date and that we're going to be asking you as our 15th speaker. And it is this: what, David, is work to you?
Well, work is, in my definition, anything you want to get done that's not done yet.
I had a sense that asking you that question would probably, you know, you'd probably give us a very short and very pointed answer, which you're doing. I love that.
Well, that is my work, is really to help people define what that work is. And it's just that most people have made a lot more commitments than they're conscious about. So a lot of what I developed was the algorithm and the formula for how do you define what your work is. I mean, the late Peter Drucker told anybody who's a knowledge worker that the toughest job is defining your work. So it's, I gave you a simple answer, but it's not a simple thing to do.
So could you maybe tell a bit about the history, how you ever came to that?
Well, I am the laziest guy in the world, but I also like to be able to afford to live nice places and have good wine and good food. So how can you do both? So it seems like from the very beginning, I was always interested in how do you make things easier? I mean, I wake up in the morning thinking, how much easier can I get across the room? How much easier can I get done whatever it is I need to get done? And I thought everybody thought that way, but I guess apparently not. So it's not that I've always been organized. People often think of my work as organization. And there's a key component that does hinge on organizing. So that you don't have to keep rethinking what things mean, but that's only out of a lazy factor, not out of a because I like to get organized factor. Mm. So that's part of it. That's a kind of a glib answer. So a little more realistic answer was I had two different vectors or two different dynamics going on in my life that intersected. One was my personal interest in just high-performance behavior and consciousness and how do you become – you know, how do you tap into invisible things so you make the visible world work better for you? So in almost every different aspect of that you can imagine. So that was one side of it, and I've never really lost that curiosity and that interest. And then at the same time, after lots of different professions and jobs and not really knowing what I wanted to do when I grew up, and I said, you know, I just like to show up and improve situations, and also I was very fascinated by models. That is, how does a model, something you can't see, if you applied it, can make things, you know, happen different, better, improve conditions? And I was fascinated by that, and then one day discovered that actually is a profession. They call them consultants, and they pay them money to do stuff like that. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting and kind of cool. So I hung out my shingle in 1981 and was able to take I'm not sure what I want to do when I grow up and not change that, but leverage it into a profession. So I keep exploring, and it's a great thing about what I do. I get to intersect with different people in different situations almost daily that I'm able to then uncover the things that are universally applied that improve anybody's condition. So, again, I'm the laziest guy in the world, created the laziest profession in the world, so I never have to change anything I say or do, and I can show up and provide value to anybody. How cool is that?
That is pretty cool. I'm kind of wondering, like, with having had all those different professions and then kind of moving into this line of work, like, what would you say has been the one driving question behind all of your work?
The driving question behind my work. What's the driving question? That's a good question. I'm not sure I quite understand how you framed that question. I think there may be another answer to it than this, but what comes to mind is that understanding the nature of what it is that we are doing. In other words, without trying to create anything new, a lot of it is about uncovering what truly already is and then being able to make explicit the implicit things that make things work. I mean, it certainly became the essence of a lot of what GTD and getting things done was about, was just looking around to say, look, when things work, when you're on, when you're highly productive, when life is golden and good for you, what is it that contributes to that? What is it that undermines that? And is there a systematic way you can apply principles and apply techniques and apply behaviors that will get you back to that? Mm. So I suppose the part of it is just still how do we keep improving things and allowing people to do what they're here to do better, bigger, more expansive ways. Mm. So there's kind of a wide-ranging answer to that, but then it's a kind of a wide-ranging question you ask. So I don't know that there's any one driving question that shows up. I mean, on a very practical level, if I walk in, the question is, you know, what is somebody, where are they going? What's not on cruise control for them? What's not, what most has their attention? And in a way, I suppose another way to answer that, more specifically to my work, is that I discovered years ago something I didn't I've only fairly recently put this label on it or this phrase about it, but it really is the strategic value of clear space. I know we'll talk about Holacracy, and that was one of the reasons that was so attractive to me. And I think one of the reasons that my work was influential on Brian Robertson and Tom Thomason also, because a lot of what GTD is not about getting things done. You know, getting things done is not about getting things done. Getting things done is about getting clear. It's just that if you're here to get things done, if you're not getting things done, you won't be clear. So that's why I say that sort of working hypothesis is that we are all here to do something. And so if you are not appropriately engaged in whatever it is you are here to do, there's a part of you that will have trouble being, you know, the old being-doing polarity or paradox. You know, I want to just be. Well, I challenge you to just be without doing here on the material world. And the people that I know who are most into the being side of the game are the most doers that I know. So there's something that has to do with how do I line myself up so I'm appropriately engaged in the universe that I'm involved in. So I think that's, you know, that's another way to frame sort of what are the key underlying things that I look for. I mean, all I have to do is, if I came in as a consultant, I say, okay, guys, what's got your attention?
So David, could you maybe go a bit deeper into that you experienced over time that the people who are the most being are also getting the most done?
Yeah. Well, the universe is always on. I mean, if you think the universe stops, so if you want to be at one with the universe, you're going to be on. And being on can look like a lot of things. And by the way, being in a quiet meditative state is a highly active doing state, by the way. So, you know, if you're here at that level, you know, you may be in other levels of consciousness that have left the material, in which case you got a whole different definition of what doing means or what doing, you know, looks or experiences. But if you're here, then we all are, this is where we're talking, and being involved in this level, it's kind of like if you're really into being, you will then be naturally doing, not unnaturally doing. In other words, what you're not going to be doing is the busy trap and going and striving to get peace by working harder. Good luck.
Mm.
You know, the old adage, you know, you can never get enough of what you don't really need. And what you don't need to do is work harder or faster or more.
Mm.
I mean, sometimes, you know, sometimes you might need to do that. Just to, you know, from situationally, to make something better or bigger happen, but not as a sustainable way to live and work, and certainly not as a way to be able to maintain a sense of balance.
Well, there's something that you were just saying when we asked the question about the driving question. You mentioned one of the words you mentioned was systematic, and it sounds like, you know, your approach is about being almost like systematically lazy. You know, you made the joke yourself, so I'll feel free to come back to that. But I'm wondering, of course, the getting things done. Methodology or system is a way of being systematic about how we work.
It's a systematic approach.
Right, yeah.
In other words, let's take a very simple example. I think I'm the only person who's actually created the appropriate definition of what being organized means.
Mm.
How do you know when you're organized? Well, you're organized when where something is matches what it means to you. It's nothing more and nothing less. Then if that piece of paper, based upon what that piece of paper means to you, it's a bill to pay, it's a note you want to respond to, it's a piece of trash, it's a piece of reference material, if you put that where trash goes or where reference material goes or where reminders of things you need to do go or whatever the thing means to you, if you put it there and that's where those things go, that is organized. Now, why do that? Because when I look to see where something is, if I see something and it's in that place, I already know what it means. I don't have to keep rethinking what it means.
Mm.
Now, you can call that a system if you want. I just say, look, that saves your brain from having to rethink anything in terms of what it means. It's purely, simply, you know, cognitive efficiency. Like, why do you want to have to keep rethinking what you're going to do with that piece of paper? Decide once, park it where those things go. You don't have to think about it again. I mean,
and then you get into this clear space that you were just mentioning.
Sure. Well, trust me, as soon as you get clear space, it'll become unclear again because clear space gives you the opportunity to create more stuff. You know, then at some point you have to get into the zen of the process. It says you're constantly resolving, you know, to clear space.
Mm. Yeah, but there's a difference between being overwhelmed by that. or on the other end, feeling more on top of it.
Yeah, and, you know, come on, guys, you want to really stretch it. You can actually get very zen about being okay with being overwhelmed. Wow, I'm in overwhelm right now. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. So if you can see it from the right perspective, you know, you would have probably a very different definition of overwhelm if you really dug into it, what you meant by that. But I think basically what you're saying is what you want to do is move from at effect of the universe to being cause. Mm-hmm. And that's the whole idea, because what it does is appropriately engaged means you move out of the victim mentality. Victim mentality shows up for most professionals as being driven by the latest and loudest. As opposed to, wait a minute, I'm making a conscious, intuitive choice that right now I'm going to take a nap or have a beer instead of do email. And that's what I did. Might have been a bad choice. I'll live and learn. But at least I am now at least appropriately engaged with my world of work as I have defined what my work is.
Mm.
Sounds simple. And actually it is. If you really just understand that's all it's really about, and then what you're going to have to do is sort of unpack, to use a great holocratic term, you're going to have to unpack what your work really is and what all of your commitments really are. See, it's funny. People get mad at me for their lists. I go, guys, it ain't my list. You know, I'm just saying your choice is where you want to keep track of that or how conscious you want to be about what your commitments are. You know, we literally, there have been times when I've had one of my senior coaches just finally just told somebody, she said, well, how conscious do you want to be?
You were just mentioning the holocratic approach, and that's definitely something that I'd like to get into. But before we go there, I think it'd be good to talk a little bit about getting things done also, because people listening to this call, I'm sure some of the people will be very familiar with it, and others may have heard of it or not know it. I was actually just checking, did the book get written in 2001? Is that right?
Yeah, that was originally published hardback.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because I was noticing that, and I've actually felt that it must have been around so much longer than that. It feels like, of course, it's been 10 years, but it's almost this thing that you feel as it's a classic, right?
Well, you know, it's old. The truth is old as dirt. You know, all I did was identify it. I mean, it's been true forever. It's just that most people never had the issue of trying to keep track of more than one thing at a time.
Mm.
So as soon as you need to do that, you run into a cognitive road barrier, like, uh-oh, you know, because now you're going to try to keep track of commitments and try to manage things internally from a cognitive standpoint instead of just making things and dealing with the latest and loudest baby crying or we're starving, I got to go eat, or the field needs plowing or the tractor needs fixing. You know, if that's all your life is about, you can pretty much let your world define, you know, how you manage the world. That's why self-management is a very new concept. I mean, well, it's not a new concept. Come on, it's, you know, as old as any of the spiritual practices have been. But in terms of the professional side of that, you know, it's fairly new. But, yes, so I know it may feel like it. It is an evergreen book. I mean, I don't think anybody's going to write another Getting Things Done. I mean, I kind of baked it down to the basics of what that's about.
Mm. Yeah, and that's, I mean, I'd like to get into that a little, and I also wanted to introduce that, I mean, of course, this series is all about conscious business and exploring the cutting edge of that, and at the same time, you know, reading your books, Conscious Business, or as we're calling it, Waking Up the Workplace, that's not maybe the language that you're using all the time, and still we felt that, you know, going through it, actually it is. And I'm wondering whether we could go into that a little bit, because it's not the language that you're using generally. And yet it feels to us like this is so much part of conscious business and so practical, too. Like, we have been talking about some other things around conscious business, you know, leadership, adult development, creating organizational structures, for example, using holocracy. Where does it fit together as you look at
conscious business and GPD?
I'll
have to ask you. I never used the term conscious business because I don't know what the hell it means.
Oh, that's a bummer, because I was kind of going to ask you.
No, what do you mean by conscious business? I mean, you're just saying, you know, conscious? Well, yeah. How about, you know, as I said, I don't use the word, but it does wake people up. So therefore, there is an unconsciousness that's going on, and there's a lot of stuff that needs to be brought to conscious awareness. You know, just the very simple thing of getting all the stuff out of your head that's banging around in your head, and you suddenly become conscious of all the stuff that you have been committing to and have been creating and have been attached to, and you start to see that. A lot of people don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole Why? Because it's a lot easier to be unconscious about it and just go numb. Unfortunately, you don't go selectively numb. You numb out to that. You also numb out to the source of inspiration and enthusiasm and consciousness. And so, you know, of course it's waking people up. I mean, that's the whole point of it. So maybe I don't know what it means, because it is so everything I do is that.
It does sound like that, yeah. I mean, I was thinking you were putting the question back, you know, like, what does it mean to us or to me? And I guess to me it means like doing work and creating value in a way that is aligned with who I am, basically. Simple as that, I guess. It comes back to the being and doing that you were mentioning before. And it also comes back to kind of one of the terms, you know, how I introduced you around work-life balance. And there's this interesting, it's not a dash, I don't know how to call it. I guess that's my Dutch problem. But there's a dash kind of thing between, or a slash, I guess, a slash between work and life. And that's such an interesting thing, because it's almost as if you have to, you know, you wake up and you have to make a choice. Am I going to live now or am I going to work? As if it's, you know, either or. And
no, I use work-life balance if that's what they're buying.
Right.
I'll call it whatever you want, but if that's what you're buying, because what you're going to buy is balance, not work-life balance. See, if you're 24 and it's all an adrenaline rush and you're working for a software startup, you get bored going home. 99% work is balance to you, you know. But now you're 42 and you have two kids and you also want to play golf and you also want to do watercolors in addition to now the management job that they've given you, and now they're just graduating due to the whole new level of executive responsibility, and they just sliced your staff, and now they've got a whole new technology you have to. And by the way, they're going to put you in charge of buying this whole new company, and oh yeah, now just try to stay balanced inside of all of that. There's, you know, it's the same issue, essentially, called, look, am I doing what I think I ought to be doing? And back to your earlier point, Diederik, I mean, yes, essentially, all GTD is about is becoming aware of what it is that you are doing, and are you appropriately engaged in it? And if you are, then time will disappear. And time can as easily disappear when you're writing a proposal, when you're fixing a window, when you're playing with your kids, you know, when you're doing anything. It's just that state of being on, if you will, is the optimal state from which to do anything. You are the most conscious then. So, you know, when you're, you know, then you'll make better choices. You'll be more situationally aware, which, by the way, is a term I've borrowed from the U.S. military training. That's a lot of what, first of all, they were teaching fighter pilots to be, is something called situation awareness. But, you know, in other words, how many different horizons can you be aware of at any one point in time? Is a missile about to come up your ass? And by the way, do you have enough gas? And by the way, what's your altitude? And by the way, what's the storm that's coming up in front of you? And how far are you, you know, how many things can you be aware of at any one point in time that might be mission critical at any point? And so if you get hung up, that is, you get too distracted, too attached to one thing, and don't have the ability to be, title of my second book, ready for anything, then there's a part of you that will over or underreact, and you're likely to die. Well, guess what? That old sort of, that admonition of being situationally aware is now having to be taught to junior officers, because in the kind of global terrorist-ridden world we're in right now, a junior Air Force officer might have their helicopter shot down, and the CNN, you know, news team is going to be in their face with a microphone, and the world is going to be listening. So how situationally aware are they? And it turns out, you know, a number of the people in the military that are big champions of GTD and my stuff just said, David, you know, what GTD does is it gives you, optimal situation awareness. At any point in time, something happens in your life, you know, what is your ability to re-engage appropriately with it, you know, as things change? So that's kind of neat about, you know, I may be getting off the topic you started this with, but it's the trail my brain's running down right now, which is that is really the conscious, how do I become conscious, you know, essentially optimally conscious about what's going on so that I can, you know, deal with it most appropriately. But it's really about finishing what you're here to do. So, you know, to your point, when you say, yes, when you're bringing to work who you really are, and, you know, how you're doing that is manifesting who you really are. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
And I guess, like, the one of the parts of the inquiry that we have is also, how would organizations look like if they would work more from this place, you know, be that more a more conscious choice from how they engage their activities, you know, or like the optimal situational awareness. So I'm kind of wondering if there's maybe something you can say about, you know, how an organization looks like that is really, really working with all, you know, in this really situational aware way.
Well, in a very tactical way, you know, a GTD-esque office is very quick and very quiet.
Mm.
They're very highly responsive to what's going on. In another way, you know, let me say this, and there is a tie-in with it. One of the things that I say is that when you really pay attention to what has your attention, or when you pay appropriate attention to what has your attention, you'll then find out what really has your attention. Which, by the way, when you start to give it appropriate attention, will allow you then to see what really has your attention. So the clearer you get in organizational life, the more obvious it will be that the big questions are the big questions. And, you know, what are we about? What are we doing? What matters to us? And all of those great conscious business kind of questions, you start to be able to actually address those as opposed to trying to go top down. If you try to address those issues, but you truly have 3 weeks worth of unprocessed emails yelling and screaming in your head, good luck. Good luck. You'll be doing conscious business as a way to avoid your real business.
It's interesting that you were talking about then you have time to address the big questions. I'm really like looking at holacracy and thinking about how it interacts with feedback loops, and I really feel that that there's a difference. Like they sometimes describe different feedback loops, but like the first level is more about what you're doing and in a way, you know, just getting it done, the basics. And then on the second level is how are we actually working together. And many companies where when they didn't have the time to get those things organized, it's very difficult to look more into the why are we doing what we're doing, you know, the questions that are more the vision, the strategy, and the intention. And I was wondering if that's something you can comment on from your experience.
Well, yeah, I mean, the way I describe it in getting things done is I talk about the different horizons that we have these commitments. And there's six that I've identified somewhat arbitrarily, but they're actually very different conversations and very really different content. You know, there's level one, which are the actions that you need to take, you know, emails to send, things to talk to people about, things to buy at the store. There's level two, which are all the projects that you need to finish that are driving a lot of those actions. You know, I need to get tires on the car. I need to hire an assistant. I need to launch an ad campaign. Then you have level three, which are all the areas of focus and responsibility which cause you to have projects. Oh, yeah, I need to grow my staff. I need to manage assets. I need to manage my career. I need to manage my health. And that's a level three kind of conversation, if you had that. Level four conversation would be, where are you going about all that 12 or 18 months from now? What would you like your health to be? What would you like your career to be? What do you want your company to have accomplished? Level five says, what would wild success in the long term look, sound, and feel like, career-wise, lifestyle-wise? Level six says, what's your essence? You know, what's the essential part of your intentionality here on the planet and your core, the core things that are really of importance to you? Those are six very different conversations, by the way. Very different content. And when you say feedback loops, I say, well, at some point, you will create a tension, speaking holocratically, if a company is going to buy you or a company shows up that says, gee, would you buy us? You're going to have to then, that will create a tension where you're going to have to raise your conversation to, excuse me, what business are we in? And that's where you're going to have to start to, and or you have a spouse or a life partner that they come home tonight and say, gee, I've just given a major career opportunity. We're going to have to move to Afghanistan for a couple of years, but it'll be really cool. I guarantee you that will create a tension that will force you to think about lifestyle and career and force you to then, that'll give you a feedback loop to lift the conversation to a different level to find out more about essence and direction in terms of where you're going. Now, you can wait for those events to trigger those tensions, or you could recognize a more subtle tension internally that says, you know, it would be a real good idea to be clear about that so that we are able to take advantage of opportunities and challenges as they show up and not have them throw us out of whack. So if you tracked with me there, there's lots of different levels of subtlety about what a feedback loop is, but it really still comes down to the very simple thing about GTD and holacracy. Where's the tension?
So could you maybe comment then on like how Inolacracy, the different levels of how it's being organized, is also related to the different horizons and the different or feedback loops, like the operational meeting or the governance meeting?
Sure. Yeah. Well. Yeah, and you know, well, what Brian, you know, Brian took from GTD, the whole idea of projects and next actions in terms of the tactical meetings as the deliverables for that. So understanding how do you define work operationally and tactically, you know, was, you know, that's, yes, that is at that level. When you speak about governance, then you're talking about areas of focus and responsibilities. So when you talk about roles and accountabilities, those are not things to finish. Those are just things you need to maintain at certain levels that are okay with you. And so, you know, then you're dealing with level three stuff when you're just talking about, you know, creating roles and accountabilities. And, you know, I'm accountable to make sure that X, Y, and Z happens, or that we have sufficient X, Y, and Z, or whatever those things are. So, yeah, those are those levels. And then strategy kind of combines all of the larger, bigger stuff in terms of the levels four and levels five, where you're talking about where do we want to be 18 months from now, or where do we want to be 5 years from now. And, you know, they're somewhat arbitrary in terms of those kind of time frames, but there's a different conversation between what would wild success, if you were fulfilling your purpose, wind up, look, sounding, feeling like, where you're doing really envisioning an ideal scene, ideal scenario building. And then you have more strategic stuff called, yeah, and therefore in the next 18 months by the end of 2012, here's what we need to have true. And all of that can show up then in your strategy meetings, because strategy might, you know, and the nice thing about it is, and why Holacracy fit with my style, is let's not go give some arbitrary template. Let's just ask what's true for you. How far can you see? And what's, you know, where do you see there? And I think, you know, Tom and Brian came up with a really nice model that I like a lot. It maps very much to what I was doing initially anyway, in terms of working with people without being too constraining, but mostly just tapping, okay, let's frame the conversation at this horizon and then see what shows up here.
And would you then say that, like, that the essence horizon is then more related to really what's the purpose of the organization?
Right. Essence is very similar to roles in that, you know, it's kind of like here's what we are doing all the time right now, and here's what we're maintaining, and here's our criterion for how we're deciding whether we're on course or off course. You know, is that your ultimate criterion? Is this supporting aim or purpose? You know, is what we're doing supporting aim or purpose? So essence is really a little different. It's really more of the gestalt, the where are we right now. You should be doing your essence right now. As a matter of fact, that's the best way to find out what your essence is look around and ask yourself, what are you really doing?
Hmm.
Because that the DNA is already present. So a lot of this is just unfolding what is it and making what you're implicitly doing more explicit. So essence is a little different conversation. So strategy doesn't create your essence. You know, that's essence is what drives a strategy.
So in making it all work, you were saying that the essence of GTD comes down to perspective and control, right?
Yep.
And you know, we've been talking a little bit about perspective, gaining perspective by looking at those different horizons. What about the control piece? What's the systematic approach of GTD there?
If your ship is sinking, you don't care where it's pointed. So, you know, if your ship is sinking, called I can't manage my head, I can't manage my projects, I can't manage my commitments, I can't manage my technology, I can't manage my relationships. So that's what I mean by control. I don't mean control. I go to try to go control your teenager, or go control your partner, or go control the weather. Good luck. I'm talking about control, where at least in English, you know, that it's I want something. I need to get something under control, like my boat or my car or my desk or my head or this conversation. You know, is this interview under control right now, or is it flying out of control? All I did was uncover the algorithm, or what are the behaviors we go through. If our kitchen's out of control, you're going to go do five things to get it back into control. If your company is out of control, you're going to do five things if you want to get it, you know, as quickly and efficiently into control again, or your country or your company, any of those. And basically that's what I did. I just identified what it is that we all do, and the first thing, you know, it's five phases of it. You know, so and those actually have very, very real behaviors. But they're very different behaviors, and for each of those phases, and different tools that you'll use. So I just identified with those and got very, very specific and detailed about that, because people need that. the complexity and speed and volume of stuff that people are dealing with that is so quickly and easily throwing them out of control right now, you need to have an equally fast and intricate and sophisticated system to be able to keep it in control. Mm. So as simple as those five stages are, there's quite a bit of practice and not so much skill. Everybody has the skill, but it's really how do I create the right habitual behaviors? Everybody has the skill to empty their in basket. They just don't.
So could you give us, I don't want to get too much into it. I'm also keen to hear a little bit more about the implementation of Holacracy at the David Allen Company. But before we go there, I know there's some people that amazingly probably haven't read your book. Could you give us the kind of the whirlwind tour of those five stages? Because having mentioned it, I think people are kind of dying to hear a little about it.
Sure. Stage one is collect or capture anything that has your attention that is not on cruise control. Anything that has your attention. Usually that means anything incomplete in your world, anything incomplete around you that's not finished yet, anything that doesn't belong there permanently, all represent things that are in process, in motion, you have some level of attention on or about. So that's the first stage, is identify those. Second stage is, sooner than later, decide exactly what those things mean to you. In other words, what are you going to do about it, if anything? What outcomes are you committed to? What action steps, very next action steps, are required? So that's how you, first of all, you need to make sure you've captured all your email so you haven't lost it. And then you need to look at the email and decide, look, do I need to move on this or not? If it is something to move on, is there some project I need to keep track of or some outcome that I'm committed to do now that I've got this input? And by the way, what's my very next action I need to take on this? So these are the sort of operational executive decisions that you need to make about those things that you do have attention on. That's stage two. Now, once you do that, very quickly, stage three, you better organize those things based upon the meaning you just decided. We talked about that before. You better park those someplace. Otherwise, it'll crawl back up into your psyche. And you'll feel out of control again. If you decided to make a phone call about that email, but you didn't park some reminder that you'll see when you're at a phone and have time, then you've just became hugely inefficient again. It started to suck back up into your brain. Stage four is, once I've organized all of these, my reminders of what my work is and what things mean to me, I need to then build a reflection and review process where I step back and look across the whole gestalt of all of the actions I'm committed to do, all the projects and outcomes I'm committed to do, all the things that I have coming toward me in my world, all the things that I need to, in other words, I need to step back and do sort of an executive review on a consistent basis of what all that is. And then included in that would be reviews of all these different horizons in your commitments, so that then stage five, now I make a choice that this email is what I'm going to do, or I'm not going to do any email, I'm going to take a nap, or your final choice about how you then engage your material resources, then the best practice there is to have done the first four. I've captured everything that has my attention. I've decided what I'm going to do about it in terms of actions and outcomes. I've organized those appropriately. I've stepped back and looked at the whole game, and therefore this choice I'm making is now an appropriate engagement from an intuitive judgment call as opposed to driven by the latest and loudest. So that's in essence what GTD, or the Getting Things Done process, is really all about. Mm. There's the basic idea or the basic theory or principle at work here is that is externalizing all of your commitments and objectifying your work outside of your psyche as opposed to internally in your psyche. And that's my big message out there. I don't know how long I'm going to be preaching this, but the world is still using their psyche as their system instead of a systematic approach, which then allows the psyche to free up and be a tool for intelligence and intuition. If your psyche is still trying to be remembering and reminding stuff, you do not have any kind of bandwidth to think creatively, innovatively, or to be thinking at some of these more meaningful horizons, as we talked about before. So what you want to do is, as efficiently as you can, get all that stuff off your mind so that, you know, so that it's not distracting you from, you know, what you ought to be focused on. The interesting paradox is that the more it's on your mind, the less it's getting done. Because the reason something will be on your mind is because there's some tension unresolved, some decision you haven't made about what you're going to do about it, or you haven't parked the results in some systematic way that you trust that the thing will get dealt with appropriately. But you don't have to finish anything to get it off your mind. What you do have to do is make the appropriate decisions about it and park the results in a trusted system.
Mm. And that's also really the link between GTD and Holacracy, which, you know, we've talked about earlier when we interviewed Brian Robertson, sure. You know, becomes so so clear, because GTD, I guess, is an individual practice for, you know, creating the clear space that we were talking about before. And I guess Holacracy does the same. So exactly the same principles that you were just mentioning is something that Holacracy does too, but not just for an individual, but for an organization. Not even a group of people necessarily, but really the organization itself. And you're in a position, you know, having, of course, originated GTD, but then also implemented Holacracy in your company, to really kind of see that dynamic play out. And I'd like to get into that a little bit. But before we do that, there are probably some people that haven't heard about Holacracy, and I thought it'd be nice to ask you, what would you say is Holacracy from your experience?
Well, Holacracy is just a systematic approach to be able to identify tensions or what has an organization's attention and be able to resolve it as quickly and efficiently as at a lower level as possible in the organization. Mm. So, I mean, that's one way to functionally define it. A little more esoteric way to describe it is, as GTD, or getting things done, basically provides a methodology for getting to individual mind like water. In other words, getting clear. Holacracy provides a way to get organizational mind like water. Because you can get a lot of very clear people together and it sucks. You know, that's why, as Brian said, you know, look, you get a lot of people that get their own act together, but that somehow when they get together in an organization, organizational life, and how do you intersect with other people and their jobs and roles and responsibilities? What happens as soon as one plus one, and as soon as you go from a one-person organization to a two-person organization, you have a beast, because now you have to define roles and accountabilities and the division of labor, which then adds a huge level of complexity in terms of my agreements with myself. What are my agreements now with the organization and with where the organization is going? And so, you know, Holacracy was just, you know, and it was interesting to find out when I heard Brian speak, because I met Brian at the Conscious Capitalism Conference in 2010, and we were both speakers, so... you know, I ran across him then, and I said, wow, that sounds exactly like applying GTD to organizational life. I wonder if these guys have really done it. So I went to went and tried to prove them wrong as fast as I could so that I could put it to sleep or implement it as fast as possible. And they did a marvelous job. I mean, Brian and with Tom added to it, did pretty much like I did, only probably faster than I did, in terms of baking down what are the real operational principles, and then just made them explicit and built in a process to be able to make that work. So my hat's off to them. And so I just jumped in full bore. I said, I can't just partially do this, because this really is kind of an all-or-nothing game in terms of changing the operating system for the organization and how we operate. But it really just made, you know, and it took it to us. We were a pretty hip and pretty conscious organization to begin with. But what it did was it unmasked, you know, all of the things that still got in the way. Heroic leadership, oh, man, were we victims to that. You know, sure, let me go be a great leader and, you know, read all the great books and how do I be a good boss and how do I get everybody involved, and then you wind up taking on everybody's issue and not having a way to sort of build in the accountabilities and get rid of the victimhood, you know, stuff, and, you know, people basically just pointing fingers and saying, go let daddy fix it. You know, and that change was a huge change just for us.
So you're saying that in an organization of, there's around 40 people, did you say?
Yeah, there are 45 of us, I think.
45? 45 people that I can imagine, 44, that are practicing GTD at probably kind of world-class level, I imagine. And apparently you're saying you can, you know, put a group of people together that are super clear, and that doesn't mean that the organization is super clear. So how did Holacracy impacts the David Allen Company?
Well, and, you know, actually, the way I've seen it impact anybody that begins to implement it, it took a huge amount of pressure off of my back in terms of, as you know, running the company. It allowed, it gave people a voice, a way to play all the way through the organization, and as opposed to just paying lip service to that, it actually gave people that voice to be able to do it. Provided a way to make sure that probably one of the most profound things that I guess was a big awareness for us and represented, you know, that change was the how to describe this? Basically, not hijacking other people's agendas and letting a lot of what shuts down in organizations is people really don't feel like they have a voice or were listened to. And so how can you trust that they can be a sensor in your organization? So building an organizational sensing capability, and I saw it happen very fast with us, where anybody at any level can sense anything that might be an opportunity or an improvement, or something off that needs to be fixed or looked at, that everybody then could be both expected, challenged to, and given the opportunity to be a sensor and to actually have a place to get that resolved. Not that it would be, answered appropriately or not in their mind, not necessarily the answer they would want, but they would at least notice and be willing to agree with the agreements that the organization had put in place. So we say, yeah, well, I don't agree with that, but, I'm trusting that the way we've structured the organization will live and learn, and, we'll make that happen, and we'll fix it if it's a wrong choice. So that was one one big area, I think, that made a big difference for us. I think another one is that, what Holacracy built in was the whole concept of dynamic steering, which was such a relief. And, as Brian and Tom would tell you, every single CEO or person running a company, when they start to run across this, goes, oh, my God, the ability to be able to, the ability to know that every decision we make can be revisited by anybody at any time. What a cool thing that is. So
that's
that way,
a little scary too, right? For
oh, totally scary.
For an executive.
Oh, totally scary. I mean, the whole change of predict and control to dynamic steering. Those are fancy words, but that's a very real thing that happens, and it's a very real thing that happened to us. And that was kind of a big awareness on our side, was how much in predict and control we really had. We're still operating, somewhat unconsciously. Let's try to make sure that some potential problem doesn't happen. So let's build in more rules and accountabilities and structure that then starts to hamstring everybody. And then everything just takes so damn long and so much time and so much energy to make any decision about anything. Nobody wants to decide about anything. So it totally constipates the decision process. And you kind of have to experience both sides of it to see how much of a change it really makes, because most people, are not that conscious about how much they're operating in a predict and control environment and how much that causes sort of an organization to go into a lot of victims and a lot of heroic leaders and an awful lot of people sort of shutting down when they show up.
So what I was wondering, David, during the Holacracy implementation, what has been the biggest challenge for you?
Well, let's see. The biggest challenge in the Holacracy implementation has been, I can say is personally. I'd say personally the biggest challenge, but here's what comes to mind, and I say it's a challenge because it's actually a fabulous opportunity and a fabulous thing. It's kind of the flip side of it. The scary thing, part of it was, am I truly willing as the majority owner of the company to give over decision-making to the evolutionary purpose of the organization and trust that these 44 people are appropriate sensors that will course correct this for the highest good and be willing to make that commitment? That's a pretty scary thing to do. Or at least that's certainly an out of my comfort zone sort of a thing to do, but I did it. I figured I couldn't halfway do that. So doing that and then still trusting that I'm not the real decision maker. It's really the biggest challenge for me is to shut up, be quiet, and listen in internally, on my own spiritual self or my own inner voice. About, okay, what is this organization's purpose? And I am just a messenger and just a tool for that. And let's let the organization decide where it needs to go and how to respond to this situation. And that's probably the constant ongoing sort of challenge that I have. is to be able to truly put up or shut up, as we say, and to really operate that way and give everybody the freedom to be able to make those decisions.
So I can imagine that there would be so many reasons not to do that. So what made you say, yes, I'm going to do that?
Because I was tired, really tired, and trying to, I had a CEO that, an initial CEO that I had hired, and it didn't work out for lots of reasons. A lot of it was just I didn't really know what I wanted or what that job really entailed and was pretty unconscious myself. I was just trying to get out of a job that I didn't feel comfortable that I could do very well. So then I spent a year trying to figure out, okay, what is it like to really run a company? And I read, all the great business books and lots of folks and talked to a lot of mentors and a lot of cool people to find out, look, what do I need to do? Because I'm not the best player for the play in terms of operationally running the business. I mean, I'm the chief evangelist and visionary for our work. But I needed to be able to get out of that. But I needed to be able to find some way that I could trust the organization could run itself. I'd made the transition of building an executive committee and trying to build then to give them sort of a lot of freedom to make decisions. And, we were experiencing, constipation, collaboration turned into constipation pretty fast in terms of decision making, and things just kind of stopped. And so I knew I needed to get the kind of CEO that I wanted, but I also knew I wanted to build some sort of organizational structure that would be much more organic. And that's when I ran across Brian. I said, geez, this is exactly what I need. This is exactly what I was looking for, because I hadn't found a new CEO yet. But I said, if there was a chance the organization could actually run itself without having to bring somebody in that would free me up, this seemed to be the perfect way to do it. So once I saw the model, I realized you couldn't partially do this model. So I had to either not do it or do the whole thing, for the whole company. And I tasted from the very beginning how challenging it was, what hard work it was going to be, but also almost from the very beginning how immediately it relieved a lot of pressure and a lot of things got unstuck that had been stuck for quite a while. And I watched it, to have very quick successes. So that was nice, too, to be able to, see that and validate this is a good thing to do. And pretty much, I'd say, 98% buy-in from everybody in the company, which was kind of surprising. Not really in retrospect, but, I was inspired by how inspired just our new hires and people junior in the organization and people all the way through very much responded to this and very much responded to our decision to do this. And all that was very cool. That was kind of a longer answer than what you asked, but that's a bit of the history of why we decided to do it then. Oh, by the way, it turned out that then the perfect and ideal CEO showed up on my radar, and he's been on board with us now. And it turned out, of course, I had to make sure that he understood what the whole Holacracy process was. So it turned out I was able to get Mike. We did an intensive, the 5-day intensive with Brian and Tom. They came out to our offices, and we did that for about 25 of our staff. And I was able to get my potentially new CEO out to at least partially part of that program. So he got to taste that, and he loved it too. He thought it was fabulous. As a matter of fact, he was quite miffed and upset that he had to go back to his job in his big corporation after he'd seen what a Holacracy meeting was like, and realized, even though he worked for a very, very big, well-known organization for how well it's managed, he said, God, it suddenly became so immediately evident how meetings just sucked, in the big organization, because he watched what a really productive meeting through Holacracy really looked like.
Yeah, I've had that experience. If you experience those holocratic meetings, then having to go through kind of normal meetings is torture.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
More or less. Yeah. So, but are you still leading the company now?
Well, I'm chairman. Mike is CEO, and he's been on board for a couple of months. We're sort of running it virtually. He's still living in Vermont, which is where his previous job was. He hasn't been able to sell his house yet, so he could move out. But so Mike's on board, and he is now lead link to the GCC and lead link for our partner circle, which we just set up. So I've just unhooked from those roles. Mm. I still have several roles on the general, the general company circle, and our program development circles. So I'm still very much engaged in the company, but I've been able to hand off pretty rapidly and thankfully to the Holacracy process. The transition's been very, very fast and very elegant.
Congratulations. I think that's something that a lot of business owners are struggling with. You know, at some point when the company grows, that it becomes almost a love-hate thing where, you know, the company can't do without you, but you maybe also want to move on.
Yeah, and a lot of people, I think, unfortunately, I think a lot of business owners want to leave the company because it was so uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I essentially was in that role. I was in that situation early on, 2 or 3 years ago. And now, with the Holacracy process and also, you know, being smarter about, you know, kind of what I needed and who I needed to work with, now it's like I want to stay more engaged with the company and not leave it. So I think using a Holacracy process or a more conscious process about the business that has real stuff and not just words, but a very real process that you can implement to make that much easier to do so that you can find what are the roles I still want to play. And what are the roles that you know, the business owner or the primary driver or founder of the business, actually they provide, you know, something that's probably close to the DNA of the company that nobody else will or can. Not that they shouldn't leave in case they wanted to do something else, but I wouldn't leave out of a negative frame. I would only leave if that just meant more expansion for them. But I think a lot of people would still love to play. They just want to play at a different level of the game. But, you know, it was either so uncomfortable they just needed to get out of it, and or they hadn't built a process or a systematic way to be able to still stay engaged without being in the way.
So would you say that the David Allen Company is a conscious business? I'm wondering also, if so, like how? What makes it a conscious business?
Again, I'm back to what we started with. I'm not sure exactly what that means other than, you know, conscious. Mm. I mean, I think yes. In the sense that, I mean, quite simply, you can't, you know, you really can't do anything more than who you are, but what you want to do is be at least who you are. So having a business where people can show up and be sort of as best they can who they are, as best they know that, and as best that they have the ability to express that and manifest that and grow that, yes, we are a conscious business.
Mm. I just wanted to... we can go on for a little bit, but I also wanted to say to people listening in that in 5 minutes or so we'll be transitioning into Q&A. So if you want to add any questions that are coming up or put them into the questions box that you'll find in the lower left of your screen if you're listening in through the web, then you'll probably get a chance to ask some of those questions. And you'll actually also have a chance to ask your questions live on the phone, but we'll get into that later. Just wanted to give people a heads up to add some of those questions. In the meantime, to get back to that point about, you know, conscious business, I mean, you were already saying that you transitioned out of the CEO role anyway. I was kind of wondering what it means to be leading a conscious business or even a holocratic organization.
I'm not sure. I think, obviously... modeling the behavior, I mean, in other words, actually doing the behavior and not being two-sided on this. You know, I think when you start to demonstrate that people can make decisions and then you support their decision-making process, you know, you're modeling what that process is all about. So I think, you know, it all starts from the top, and that's the best I could say in terms of what leadership is in a sense, is when you don't need to lead.
Mm.
When, you know, then you're getting out of the way, but supplying, you know, but showing up as who you are and just not having that be in the way. And I think part of it is it still comes back to the good old stuff that says, look, if I'm inspired about where we're going and what we're doing, but I don't have to have you inspired to be involved. You know, I'm not expecting you to be inspired to make me money. I love doing what I'm doing. Then I'm going to do it anyway, whether anybody wants to play or not. That's the way I've grown my business. Was I was just doing it if somebody else wanted to play. I said, well, sure, come on aboard. And if we can make it work, that's fine. I'm very happy to do that. But I didn't build the business as an entrepreneur or as an ambitious, you know, sort of business person. I built it simply because I was looking for a decent job for myself and what I was doing started to be relatively successful, and there was more demand than I could deliver. So I said, well, okay, well, there are people around that can help deliver this, and they sort of buy into this as well. Then, you know, terrific. So, but I think there are many different kinds of leadership. I think as long as I have integrity about that for myself, and people catch that I'm inspired about it, and they're inspired about the work, and we do that as long as I stay real and honest, and you know, be as good a person as I can, and sort of live up to ideally my own ideals and standards that we hold in the company. You know, boy, what else can you do?
Mm.
That seems to be it.
What I was wondering, David, is that you mentioned that one of the core roles that you know that you have and have had is like the visionary part and you know the developing new ideas. So could you maybe say something about like the latest developments in either your thinking or you know what we can kind of like expect towards the future from what you are doing?
Well, I think where our work is being called now is in more strategic areas of culture change, where organizations are beginning to really understand and I think get that the getting things done process, as even if it's just individual behaviors, has huge organizational impact. One very well-known big organization consulting firm right now is piloting our work because they've looked around themselves and said, gee, we are not nearly as productive or as efficient as we ought to be given our reputation in the world out there. And so, you know, using this as a way to build a common lexicon inside the culture, a common set of personal behaviors. I mean, even though we said, yeah, sure, you could have a lot of clear people, but they get together in an organization and it becomes unclear. But I, you know, just got 30 years of lots of data and experience where when any one or two or three or four people start to sit down and keep stuff out of their head, keep track of all their commitments, you know, clean up all their, you know, they just clean up their email on a regular basis, you know, so that people don't have to keep banging on the door and trying to get on their calendar in order to be able to get a decision made. Just even little things like that, and just making sure they start to manage meetings with such a way that, hey, what are we trying to accomplish? And they don't end discussions without saying, what's the next action? Is this yours or mine? And they start to have integrity with keeping track of all that. Man, that makes a huge difference, and it can make a huge difference in a culture. Right now, meetings and email are the big beasts that are eating up most executives' consciousness that are getting in the way. And, you know, a lot of the emails are unconscious. A lot of the emails are happening because they're not, you know, appropriate individual behaviors out there for people to manage this stuff, or, you know, appropriately. A lot of meetings are unconscious because somebody didn't, you know, themselves say, wait a minute, why exactly do I need to go? You know, a lot of the executives that I'm coaching right now, you know, when they start looking at their calendar, they go, oh, my God, I have no time to even process my in-basket or my meetings. What the hell am I doing? And so they start to then rethink, wait a minute, should I be going to all these meetings? Golly, you know, why am I doing, and they start to become more conscious as they start to look at what they're doing and why they're doing it. So adding, you know, at least starting from that place, it would be pretty difficult to implement Holacracy if you did not have a GTD, you know, behavior set built into your culture.
So it's interesting.
You know, I think Brian and Tom and I and Mike are going to be, you know, spending a lot more time together as we find cultures that are very interested in the 1-2 punch, you know, of both of those.
Because it's interesting that you mention about the cultural change, because from our own experience implementing Holacracy, one of the key insights that I had from that is how actually through changing the structure, you actually have an impact on the culture instead of, for example, many companies where they say, like, you know, we have to change the culture and you're going to do, you know, you're going to go with the whole team somewhere. I'm often using the metaphor of, like, if you put 16 people in an elevator, that actually has such an effect on the people being so crammed together by the structure of the elevator that creates a certain culture. And by just removing the structure, opening the doors and letting people out and giving them more space, automatically you will actually have an impact on the culture. So
yeah.
My hypothesis is that actually changing the structure is one of the biggest ways how you can actually change culture.
You can, absolutely. I totally agree with you. As I often say, you know, you can go to a personal growth training, you can go off-site on the weekend, and everybody can cry and hug and love each other, and they'll still want to shoot each other at the staff meeting on Monday morning if they didn't get clear about whose role something was or who's going to handle it and how to handle that. So, you know, all the best intentions and all the best words and all the best sort of love each other and be nice and all that kind of stuff, if you don't have an appropriate structure that will support that, I think you need both. I think you could probably implement a holocratic structure and still, you know, perhaps, I think that if you, I think a culture could undermine the holocratic success or that. But if you truly did it successfully, I think you would need to have an open culture, certainly one that would be open to begin with. So I think there is a relationship between the two. But to your point, I agree, you know, that the you need to have, as a matter of fact, very, very good structures will give you the opportunity to then have people just show up as real people. Because, you know, I think people are naturally good and well-intentioned. And, you know, very few people wake up in the morning and say, wow, how can I go really screw it up today? Mm. You know, most everybody's pretty well-intentioned. And so if you create a structure where they can see that they have an opportunity to have an effect by who they are and how they operate, I think things, you know, I'm a big optimist in that regard.
So I could also imagine that you know, combining the powers of what you're doing with your company and getting things done, and with Brian Robertson of Holacracy, that you know that there are so many interesting partnerships. Is that also something that you're considering?
Sure. Yeah. That there's a great 1-2 punch there. I'm not holding my breath in terms of how many companies you're going to find the owners of the company willing to buy into the Holacracy process.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've got a whole lot of clients, and a whole lot of our work in the world is still going to be doing a lot of great work in the world where you know, there would probably be very, very slight possibility that the Holacracy process itself could be built into it. But I think Holacracy, as you guys probably know, once you get kind of familiar with that, I think it helps mature a lot of just how you think about things and how you engage. So I think there's still a lot of improvement things that can happen. But I think we're still at early stages of all that. But, yes, we're delighted to be in those conversations, and we're having them regularly.
Mm. You were saying before, you know, what made you say yes to that kind of opportunity that Holacracy offered, you know, to, in a way, give up personal control, but to gain, you know, that the organization is actually steered or guided by the evolutionary purpose rather than, you know, your kind of personal vision as the founder and the owner, the majority owner.
Yeah, it would be more accurate to say to give up the illusion of control.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it feels like giving up control, right? But
it feels like it, but then you start to say, wait a minute, I'm really more, things are more under control now, to my earlier description of that. Things are much more under control than they were when I was trying to control it, or when I thought I had to.
Mm. I was going to ask you, you know, if I had a panel of entrepreneurs here that were kind of considering that, you know, what would you say to them as, you know, an entrepreneur that has gone through that?
Take a taster day. You know, you really do need to experience this. So I know, you know, I don't know if you guys have that available in Europe, or Brian and Tom are available for that, or either one of them. But just to get your senior team together and say, look, here's the conceptual model. If they kind of get it cognitively, hey, that kind of makes sense, then actually start to experience a little of this. See what happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what they did for us. They came out and actually took our senior team through a governance meeting. And boy, did that open a lot of doors, and, you know, the light bulbs just went off right there. Oh, wow, that's very real. Because this is not some academic, theoretical, hope it might work. You know, just like GTD, the process itself does work, and it's very powerful when you apply it. So I think you need to, the entrepreneurs would just need to say, look, are you tired? Would you like to be able to, you know, build in a lot more under controlness, you know, through the company, and you know, be able to, you know, have a process that's alive and well that'll keep it that way.
It's interesting that you were what you mentioned in relation to the using Holacracy and the taster and everything. Because what I really noticed is that also just an operational meeting is already having so much impact for companies. And I can imagine that as Brian is calling Holacracy a practice, that what GTD is in a way also really a practice.
Yes, it is. And the nice thing about it is you kind of you implement any of it and it will improve the situation. And you implement all of it and the whole is much greater than the sum of the parts.
Right. Mm.
So my psyche was just throwing something on the table. What had my awareness was time. So I want to give people listening in a chance to also ask some questions. So I'm going to transition to Q&A. I'll just give people a few instructions for how to do that. One, if you're listening in through the Internet, on the page that you're looking at, on the lower left corner, there's a box where you can enter your question, which some of you are already finding. So you can either enter them there or, better still, we can hear your voice. So if you're on the phone, you can dial *2, and that will make you visible to us so we can unmute you, and you can actually ask your question yourself. So again, either on the web through the question box or by phone by dialing *2. And we're ready to take your questions. In the meantime, I'm suggesting, Jeroen, why don't you give us a question for David?
All right, so I have a question here. I don't know who it's from, and it's saying, I'm curious about GTD and its connection to a kind of Zen mind that you were alluding to. Do you think an actual formal meditation practice contributes to somebody's ability to get things done?
Yes, I do. In that, any kind of a formal reflection or even informal reflection or review process or contemplative process will allow you to shift your horizons in terms of what's pulling on you. It'll also allow you to be aware, much more aware of what has your attention. But I think you need an intention to be aware of what has your attention to make that connection really optimal. But yes, indeed, if nothing else, just to shift gears and to shift your rhythms will help you to be able to get more done. Just make sure you keep a pad of paper and a pen as you start to meditate, because as you start to relax, you'll suddenly realize you need cat food and you need to call your aunt and you need that to get tires on your car. You better have a place to start to unload all of the things that you'll find out that are in the way of you going quiet and going internal.
Mm. So I have a comment here from Joris from Haarlem, who is mentioning that he's using the getting things done process for more than 2 years now, and he just wants to thank you, David, for saving his life, for getting back his sleep and discovering who he is and learning to be a better person. And I was wondering, do you get a lot of reactions like that, David?
Yes, we do. So thank you very much for sharing that. That keeps us going, and nice to hear when it really sticks out there. And very much appreciate that, because this looks very simple in terms of what the model is, and it is actually pretty simple to implement, but the results can be extremely profound. So I've found very few things, and it's why I so love what I do. There are very few things I've seen in the world that have so little risk and such high payoff. So the risk-reward ratio for implementing GTD is huge, huge. So it's very easy to enter, and not a whole lot you have to put at risk, but as you have just acknowledged, lots of very cool things can happen. So thanks.
So have you ever considered, thinking about how much your idea or your vision about getting things done has, increased productivity worldwide, what the net effect has been of the whole getting things done process?
It's a fabulous thing to wonder about. I have absolutely no idea. Wouldn't it be nice if I could put some sort of cash register on that? Just give me 1% of whatever increase. But the problem is that oftentimes by implementing GTD, what you will do is suddenly decide, I'm not going to go make a lot of money. I want to go run a fishing camp in Ireland. Or, wow, I really realized I just want to become an artist. So to me, that is as successful as anybody going and making a lot of money using GTD. It's really, if one could calibrate how much more are people able to do what they're here to do, and based upon, and how much more can they express and manifest who they really are and what their capabilities are, that's what floats my boat. So, yeah, that'd be fabulous. I love to think that some of that is happening, and I know based upon how much influence a lot of the people have who have gotten GTD and it's changed their lives, I know how much that has affected people around them. So, yeah, it's a fabulous work to be involved in.
Mm. Okay. So another question from the Netherlands here is, why is the principle of the next action so powerful?
The principle of the next action, and what we mean by that, if you're not clear, is that if you're committed to move on something or to do something or finish something, the very next physical action, that is, where would you go if you had nothing to do but that project right now? Where would you physically go? What would you physically do? Would you go to a computer and write an email? Would you go to a store and buy some supplies? Would you have a conversation with your life partner? What's the very next physical action? So that's what we mean by the next physical action, is what's the very next physical thing to do. Why that is so powerful is because until you have answered that question, there is still a huge void between getting things done and where you are, because you don't know where doing happens and what tool you need. So if you haven't finished your thinking about it, there's a part of you that says you haven't finished your thinking, you haven't finished your thinking. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? And it creates this monkey mind that essentially most people have gone unconscious to, because they have so many of those things bugging them in their psyche. And if you just say, well, wait a minute, I'm just going to write them an email, and he goes, oh, okay. And believe it or not, there's a part of your psyche that shuts up once it knows that there is a plan in place. And there are now psychological studies that have now proven that when you have something that's incomplete in your psyche will keep trying to beat you up, but not for any good positive reason. It's just panicked. It says, we don't have a plan, we don't have a plan, we don't have a plan. How are we going to do it? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And so by coming up with the next action and then adding to that, parking that, a reminder of that action in some place that your psyche knows you'll see at the right time, the psyche gets to shut up and it relaxes. And it actually is what takes your attention off of it. So the reason things have your attention is because you haven't put appropriate attention on them. And a key element of the appropriate attention you need to put on something is, what's the next physical action? Where does this move forward? And what would I need to do if I were going to engage with getting this done right now?
I have another question here from Rich Ramos from San Francisco. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And he is asking, can David speak a little about envisioning outcomes? I listened to the Managing Project CD and I found this awesome.
Yeah, well, outcome thinking is, again, part of, as I say, part of the zeros and ones of GTD and getting things done. You know, quite frankly, the way you get things done is you need to know, what does done mean and where does doing happen and what does it look like? And those are things that are not that evident to people. For instance, most people have a lot of what they consider problems, but they haven't sat down and said, what's the project here? That problem being solved would look like what? So thinking about outcomes, what's the outcome of the business? What's the outcome of the project? What am I trying to accomplish here? What's the reason for this? As simple and obvious as that question seems to be, it is amazing how much people avoid getting clarity about that. Most people will avoid thinking about the final outcome until somebody can show them how to get there. And the brain actually doesn't work that way. In other words, the way you catch a ball is you see the ball already being caught, and then there's a part of you that catches up with all the stuff in between. So you need to see, well, what does a successful interview, what would be true if this were totally successful? And learning to think that way, you can actually train yourself to think that way as a habit. Wait a minute, you know, what would this feel like once this is accomplished? What would wild success for this project look, sound, or feel like at the end of that game? And again, a lot of people don't want to set themselves up for failure, so there's a kind of a boo-hoo victimness that prevents people from sort of thinking or operating from that kind of positive framework of mind. And a lot of people want to know how to get there before they see there. You know, where's the there? So, you know, as simple as that may sound, it's a very challenging thing to do, but a very important one to do. What are we trying to accomplish? What's the next action? If that just became part of your families or your organizations or your team's operational vocabulary, then you would, you know, watch things, you know, shift and change significantly.
And I have actually. I mean, I have seen that go viral, even when people don't get the full GTD methodology or Holacracy. Just that one kind of principle. I have seen organizations changed by it.
Yeah, we've seen whole cultures change. If all their meetings started that way and nobody left the room without saying, so what's the next action? Is that yours or mine? That can change a culture. Mm. Just because it then reflects, wait a minute, what's got our attention? What would resolution happen? What would resolution be? As opposed to, oh, my God, ain't things awful? Oh, damn. You know, it automatically shifts that without having to go, okay, now let's all go be accountable and let's go, you know, empower everybody. We don't use those words, but by implementing these behaviors, it creates more empowerment and more accountability than anything I've come across.
Mm. So, Jeroen, do we have a final question?
Yes, we have a question here, and it's listening to you speak. It seems like getting things done has a kind of spiritual base. Do you have any kind of spiritual practice?
I do. It's not directly tied to getting things done, though, as I said, you know, a lot of my impetus for exploring what I then uncovered for getting things done was my exploration of what I called, you know, clear space. How do you get to clear space? You know, I got a black belt in the martial arts and karate many years ago, and there's a very, you know, there are a lot of sort of contemplative and even spiritual exercises in some of the martial arts. And there may be a spiritual component, but there's also a very practical component that when four people jump you in a dark alley, you don't want to have 3,000 unprocessed emails still hanging around your psyche. You know, you need to be clear. So understanding what clear is, and then using spiritual practices, and I use that with a small s, you know, that yes, there is, you know, in my experience, and it's a very real experience, that there are levels of consciousness, there are levels of experience that are unseen, that are invisible, much like thoughts are invisible and emotions are invisible, but there are also much more subtle levels of the universe. As I said before, the universe is always on. It never stops. And all meditation or spiritual practices do is just allow me to let go of some level so that I can pay more attention to other levels. So, yes, in that way, GTD is pretty much the same thing. Same thing as holacracy. Wait a minute. There is a deeper, more subtle, more sophisticated, more refined energy field available to us, but if we're filling it up with static and a bunch of noise and a bunch of distraction, we can't have access to it. We can't hear it, nor can we implement from it if we, you know, get good stuff there. So in that way, yes, I guess GTD does have a foundation, but I would use, again, the small s, spiritual meaning. Yes, there's a lot of subtle things that invisibly, that's why I said I've always been fascinated by how the relationship between the invisible and the visible. You know, from my first job as a kid at 5 years old was being a magician. It was one of my 35 professions. I loved it. Gee, what if you could just say magic words and things would show up? That's the real lazy way to live your life. So I've always had a fascination with it, and that's why I was a philosophy major, and then I studied history of thought, and I began to uncover paradigms. And this is back, you know, and my first degree was in intellectual history, and I read, you know, Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, where a fascinating book, one of the first that started to describe cultures as living organisms, that people within a culture, the way they thought, the way they acted, the way they expressed themselves, were all based upon a particular geist or psyche of that culture. And that was sort of the early days, and now we talk about paradigms and belief systems and so forth. And so I've always been fascinated by all of that stuff. If you wanted to call that spiritual, I'd say, sure, that's what that is. But also, yes, I do have spiritual practices because, you know, in my experience, there's lots of stuff going on a lot of different levels. It's very cool. That's informing and driving and really the big master of this game here, though we're here because this is a great learning opportunity to be able to improve ourselves on some of those other levels as well.
Beautiful. In terms of time, I want to move into closing thoughts, but before we do that, I also wanted to ask, for people that didn't know getting things done and that want to learn more, what would be a good place to start?
Our website's a good one, davidco.com, davidco.com. A couple of things about that, if you're taking notes right now, if you go to davidco.com/info, I-N-F-O, there's some free articles there that you can download, you know, about some of the different tactical aspects of this. And also, if you go to another site called gtdiq.com, gtdiq.com, there's a little two-minute evaluation you can take and fill out online, and it will give you a sense, it will kind of dot you on the matrix of control and perspective, and it'll give you a sense of sort of what are some of the key dynamics that affect your ability to sort of be in control and your ability to have the appropriate focus, which are some of the key elements of GTD. So both of those are kind of fun, lots of stuff people can then surf around once they get into that.
Right. Thanks. Very good. So just quickly some closing thoughts before we finish the conversation. Jeroen, do you want to share yours?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the two sides of it, that it's so practical what you talk about and what you do. Like, I've really experienced how it's making a difference to having the GTD approach. And what I'm really noticing is that it's kind of like the simple, small, easy to follow rules, that by doing that more and more times, it has so much a deeper impact on the way of thinking. You know, start thinking in terms of next action, or start thinking in terms of workable. And I really believe that these kind of parts of simplicity that have so much complexity in them are one of the best ways to really transform like organizations or human systems working together. And I just really want to thank you for having made such a massive contribution to that. And I was a bit jokingly about the net effect of getting things done, but in a way, it's huge, and it will just continue to have so much impact. And I'm very happy that we could talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Jeroen. Thank you.
Yeah, just briefly, my closing thoughts. I mean, the first thing that came up is that, this series has been all about exploring the cutting edge of conscious business. And I think what we've been doing today is exploring the cutting edge, but at the kind of foundational end of the spectrum. This feels like it's so foundational to conscious business, but really, as you kept on saying, you were taking just a piece of conscious there, really to any way of doing business, creating value, doing work, being in the world. It's almost, there's no getting around it. And I really appreciate how you've kind of broken that down. Another thing that I'm taking is the what you were mentioning, the strategic value of clear space. Like, that feels like a very powerful way of looking at this, of framing it. And then finally, really want to appreciate you for giving me permission to be systematically lazy. I love that. And it feels like a huge relief. And at the same time, I also know that that is such a powerful thing. So thank you. And I want to close by asking you, whether you have any closing thoughts to share.
I do, actually. What occurs to me is that, and I'll use a holacracy model here, and people can take it for whatever it might mean to them, is that, moving into thinking about my business as having its own evolutionary purpose that is out beyond me, that I'm just an instrument to play some role in that, no matter what kind of ownership or what kind of founder I was, but really to imagine it has its own purpose. I can't imagine any business, if you really ask that business as its own energy field and its own entity, what is your purpose? I can't imagine any of them going, I'm going to go out and screw everybody. I'm going to run over everybody in the world. I'm going to be a nasty thing, and I want to just take over the world and eat up any of my competition. I don't think any business would ever say that. And so I think it's only the sort of negative side of the human factor that comes out of our insecurities and our fears that then starts to screw up business and makes business unconscious. I think business is conscious, period, if you really think of it in perhaps that most elegant way. So I appreciate you guys being able to hold a focus like that, and it's been fun to share at that level with you.
Thank you. Just quickly for people listening in, next week, same time, we're interviewing Brett Thomas from Stegen, which is going to be a lot about leadership and conscious business. And for now, with what you were just saying, David, I'm really reminded of, I think it's kind of the tagline that Holacracy One uses, which is liberating the soul of organization. Thank you. That really came up strongly when you were just speaking. So again, thank you so much for joining us on Thanksgiving, particularly, and for kind of offering your wisdom to everyone listening in and everyone that will be listening in the future. Yes, thank you. That feels like an appropriate thing to say on Thanksgiving. Talk soon.
And thank you, guys. This was fun. It was a great interview.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.